The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 16th of June 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme...
I'm going to make clear to President Putin that there are areas where we can cooperate if he chooses. And if he chooses not to cooperate, then we will respond.
U.S. President Joe Biden takes a somewhat more robust line than his predecessor as he prepares to meet his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. We'll have the latest from Geneva and analysis in the studio. Also ahead, China undertakes its biggest ever buzzing of Taiwan's air defense zone. We'll look at what China is trying to prove to whom. Later in the show, we'll speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning New Yorker reporter Lawrence Wright about his new book on how the United States fumbled COVID-19.
Leadership would have made a huge difference. We never had a federal plan. We really needed one. And you can't manage a pandemic without leadership at the top.
And Monocle's culture editor Chiara Ramella will join us with a roundup of what's making news on her beat. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Right about now, or very shortly indeed, US President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin will begin a lengthy one-on-one discussion at their summit in Geneva. Both sides have been keen to manage expectations in advance, describing relations between the United States and Russia as somewhere in the vicinity of rock bottom. It is highly unlikely that the meeting will generate quite as much global bewilderment as the previous such encounter between Putin and former US President Donald Trump in Helsinki in 2018, which Trump approached like a bungling underling winging a performance review. But what can we anticipate? Well, I'm joined with more from Geneva by Monocle's correspondent at the summit, Florian Egli, and in the studio by Stephen Diel, Russia analyst and regular Monocle 24 contributor. Florian, to you first of all, in Geneva, what is going on now where you are?
Hello, Andrew. So where we are, actually 16 minutes ago, the Corso has left the airport. Vladimir Putin has arrived. Joe Biden is already here since yesterday. And so they should literally, drive by our offices in about 5 minutes. And it is expected that Biden arrives at the villa where the talks will be held first. So it's scheduled in just 7 minutes at 10 past one that there will be an official greeting by the Swiss president, photo opportunity afterwards. And then just shortly after 1:30, the bilateral meeting is supposed to start. Interestingly, only Joe Biden is greeted by the Swiss president. Vladimir Putin did not want to have an official reception by the president of the Swiss Confederation at the airport and preferred to arrive in somewhat stealth mode, I would almost say. So there is a live stream from the Department of Foreign Affairs in Switzerland, and you could barely actually see that he arrived. It was all very well covered up and very much in the hidden.
Florian, just staying with you, Geneva is, of course, very well used to being a venue for major diplomatic set pieces. But how big a circus has this been for the city? What kind of preparations go into getting ready for the presidents of the United States and Russia being there at the same time?
It has, of course, been larger than usual, but at the same time, International Geneva is very used to these events. So there is a whole, basically a district in the city where all the international organizations are located that is very well equipped, you know, to basically, you know, empty roads and clear the way. And the only thing that is different this time is that actually pretty large zone around the lake has completely been cleared and is just clear. So no traffic, also no public transport running across the main bridge over the lake. And the interesting thing is that you see police corps of all different kinds of cantons. So you hear people, policemen speaking Swiss German because they've been drawn in from Bern, from Aargau, so from different cantons. And they've also improvised quite a bit. So you see they're actually not on police motorcycles. They're on rented Yamaha motorcycles with like little police stickers on them. So there has been quite a bit of improvisation going on just to get together, you know, the required staff and the number of people. But all in all, it runs very smoothly. You know, residents of Geneva have been advised to work from home if possible or use public transport. Some public transport lines are diverted, but that all works very fine. There are some, of course, you know, delays in traffic, but that was very well communicated and anticipated. So all in all, a bit of improvisation here and there, but it runs pretty smoothly so far.
Bringing you in here in the studio, Stephen, if we look at what is likely to be discussed at the summit itself, we heard Joe Biden at the top of the show talking about there being areas where we can cooperate if he chooses. What are those areas? What can the United States and Russia actually get together on at this point?
Coronavirus, I suppose, is number one for that. It affects everyone. There's a greater outbreak now in Moscow than there has been in recent months. That's a real problem. They haven't got on top of it. And of course, America's had their own problems, although they're dealing better now. Climate change. So these are neutral. These are things that they ought to be able to at least nod together on. But beyond that, there's the general question of U.S.-Russia relations. Where are they going to go? How are they going to develop? There's the question of cybercrime. And interestingly, President Putin has been saying, we want to talk about cybercrime because we want to tackle it together, when everyone knows that Russia is one of the main culprits when it comes to carrying out cybercrime. But of course, he doesn't admit that. But he wants to talk about that. So I'm sure Biden will be more than happy to talk about it, but from his point of view. And then regional conflicts such as Ukraine and Syria, possibly even Nagorno-Karabakh in the Caucasus. There is a list, actually, that the Russians have already produced. Those all come on that list. But they've said also, perhaps also the American president will raise issues of Belarus, of this Navalny chap. Putin, of course, didn't say that because he never mentions him by name. And also, interestingly, of course, Biden has just come from a NATO summit and a G7 summit. So I'm sure that in the smaller group, which is basically the presidents with their foreign ministers and just those four, obviously, and interpreters, then I think that Putin will want to push Biden and find out what really went on at G7 and NATO.
Just to follow that up, Stephen, if we look at what I guess the broader picture for both of the summit attendees and Putin in particular, is it not fundamentally the case, though, that he both wants and needs an essentially adversarial relationship with the United States? I mean, it would leave him a bit high and dry if he did find himself in a position to go back to Moscow and say, well, good news, everybody, we've sorted everything out and it's fine.
It would indeed. And I wouldn't say that he's on a knife edge, but he's on actually quite a narrow ledge. Let's put it that way. Because, yes, he needs to be able to go back and saying, yes, well, of course, the American, you know, America's our adversary. You know, we're threatened by the West and so on. But the more he pushes the West and if he pushes the West into more sanctions, if, for example, Russia were excluded from the SWIFT banking system, which may not affect most of us in our daily lives, but at the big end, that is really important. And if Russia were excluded from that, that is going to have a serious effect on the Russian economy. If he were to say, well, I've been talking to Angela Merkel and Germany is going to row back on Nord Stream 2, the second gas pipeline coming from Russia through the Baltic Sea, these would have a serious effect on the Russian economy. And the reason it's a narrow ledge, because the worse the effect on the Russian economy, the worse the effect on the Russian people. We've already seen with the sanctions that were imposed after the invasion of Ukraine and the seizure of Crimea in 2014, we've already seen the Russian economy has fallen significantly. And this has hit Ivan on the ground. And the more he does that, the more Russians will be saying, hang on, you know, we're worse off now than we were. There's also, if I can just add this one, there's a parallel. A lot of people have drawn a parallel and said, oh, it's happening in Geneva. It's just like when Reagan met Gorbachev in 85. I want to go back just before that, because one of the reasons why Reagan met Gorbachev was because Gorbachev realized when he came to power that the Soviet Union was in a dire state. The Soviet economy was in a dire state, largely because the oil price then had collapsed. They weren't doing as well as they had in the 70s. And living standards had fallen dramatically. And Gorbachev, who, of course, was more friendly to the West, realized that he needed to have a better relationship. And Putin is almost in a similar situation because the living standards for his people have fallen. There's no real prospect of anything improving greatly in the near future. And so, yes, he can talk about this, the enemy of the West and, you know, the evil United States. But at the same time, he's got to show that there's some sort of dialogue possible, because if he pushes his own people too far, there could be trouble at home.
Just to come back to you, Florin, and we will, of course, be hearing more from you after the summit on the Daily at 1800 London time today. But we'll talk a bit more about what Russia and the United States have got out of it then. But for the moment, how big a deal is this being seen as for Switzerland? Obviously, as we've discussed, Switzerland likes to think of itself as a natural home for encounters of this kind. But is this being seen in Switzerland as a big day for the country?
So the views on this are actually, you know, very, very diverse. So, you know, I mean, it's on the front page of every single Swiss newspaper. So, I mean, that kind of speaks to the importance of it. You know, as I said before, the Department of Foreign Affairs has put up a live stream, something that I've rarely seen, I must say. So that's about as you know, as far as it goes in terms of official communication. And they've gone all that way. So, I mean, some say it is important. Others, you know, I've heard Tim Guldimann, the former Swiss diplomat, actually of very high ranks. He said yesterday in the German FAZ that, you know, Switzerland just very much overestimates its role, and basically we're the conveners here, but we're not setting any agenda items. And, you know, there is not much, you know, there were, you know, bilateral meetings between the Swiss president and Joe Biden, 30-minute meeting. I mean, that is just, you know, it's not substantive talks. It might be useful in terms of, you know, establishing first relationships. But I think what's crucial to note is, in these bilateral meetings, as a host country, you're not able to set any agenda items or to put any content, you know, on the agenda, which is quite different to international summits. So if, you know, you're the host country of an international summit, for example, like the climate negotiations and the like, then, you know, there is a lot of diplomatic preparation in terms of content going in this, and you shape the discussion. And that's really not the case here. So I think here it's really just showcasing Switzerland. It's showcasing Swiss diplomacy. But on the actual content, there is not much to influence. And maybe we stick with the showcasing for just another few seconds. I mean, there, I think Switzerland could have done more. I mean, I've discussed this on the show with Tyler once as well. You know, there are so many Swiss companies that do great things, you know, in terms of design, in terms of hospitality, in terms of food. And all of this could have been put much more, you know, to the front of things. And it's kind of, it doesn't really matter. So it's a classic Geneva summit. And there is kind of a missed opportunity there, I think. It even went as far as, says that the Geneva, the city authorities of Geneva, demanded that the restaurant next to the press center by the lake would remain open for the journalists to grab lunch. And they actually had a sign in the press center, you know, directing people to that restaurant, which then was duly removed from the federal government in Bern, because they said this is advertising and, you know, it shouldn't be done. And whereas the city of Geneva wanted to, you know, advertise a bit for a local restaurant that is remains open, is close by and serves local food. So I think that speaks a bit to this tension, you know, between, you know, we want to be neutral and just organize, but then again, it's a missed opportunity to promote some things and in a very, you know, subtle and discreet way.
Florian Egli in Geneva, Stephen Diel here in London. Thank you both. We will have more from Florian in a special edition of The Daily at 1800 UK time. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Carlotta Ribello with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Israel says it has carried out airstrikes against Hamas militant targets in Gaza in retaliation for incendiary balloons launched from the territory. Explosions were heard in Gaza City overnight in the first major flare-up since days of heavy fighting between the two sides ended in a ceasefire. Taiwan says dozens of Chinese military aircraft flew into its air defense zone yesterday, the largest reported incursion so far. Fighters and nuclear-capable bombers were among those in the so-called air defense identification zone. We'll have much more on this story after today's headlines. A court has ordered IKEA to pay a fine of 1 million euros after the Swedish furniture chain was found guilty of spying on staff in France. IKEA France was accused of using private detectives and police officers to collect private data. The group which owns IKEA has apologized and condemned the practices. And Finland's farmers have managed to negotiate coronavirus entry exceptions for the thousands of Ukrainian workers who spend the summer picking strawberries in the Nordic nation. You can find out how Finland is managing the process by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Carlotta. And as Carlotta was just mentioning, the pilots of the People's Liberation Army Air Force have once again been winding up their counterparts of the Republic of China Air Force, which is to say that China has resumed its buzzing of Taiwan. Yesterday saw China's largest ever incursion into Taiwan's air defense identification zone. 28 aircraft, including 20 fighter planes and 4 nuclear-capable Zhan H-6 bombers. The flyby is believed not unrelated to suggestions made at this week's NATO summit in Brussels that China may become more of a priority for the alliance. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue. Isabel, is this China sending a message to NATO, a message perhaps along the lines of come and have a go if you think you're hard enough?
Definitely sending messages, and there have been quite a few of what the Chinese would certainly describe as provocations. So there was the mention of Taiwan for the first time in the G7 communique. Countries are slightly chary of talking about Taiwan because of China's one China policy. So this is that was a departure. Also, the USS Ronald Reagan and its carrier group entered the South China Sea on the same day. So again, China was reacting. There's quite a lot going on with the navies because the Chinese Navy has just completed a 1 month rather long distance maneuver to practice long distance operations, which would take it as far as Guam, where, of course, there is a US military base. So there's a sense that things are really, there's a lot of squaring off going on between the respective forces. Of course, these incursions are useful to China because they're a way of mapping Taiwan's air defenses and exhausting both the planes and the pilots. And this was a particularly intrusive flight, not only in terms of numbers, but it was well inside Taiwan's air defense zone. So all in all, this was a big show of strength.
Do we know if there's any, I guess, advanced negotiation or choreography of these things between the Taiwanese and Chinese air forces? Because, you know, as we have discussed before, while these are doubtless tremendous fun for the pilots of both air forces, this is very much the all fun and games until someone loses an F-16 issue.
Absolutely. And I don't think there are advanced. I don't think there is any advance warning. And certainly the images that we have seen of the close encounters have been pretty terrifying. I don't know if you remember, there was a bomber a few weeks back and a Taiwanese fighter jet remarkably close to it. And we all remember that these things can go horribly wrong and blow up to very prolonged diplomatic incidents. So it is dangerous. But I think that if one of the purposes of this is it, well, apart from intimidating the population and trying to persuade them not to support Tsai Ing-wen, but testing and mapping the defenses is pretty critical. And it's also because everybody knows, in a sense, that's what they're doing. So again, it's saying to Taiwan, we know what your defenses are because we've tested them each time. So that, I think, argues against any advanced warning. There's a large element of display, and there's just a large element of not letting Taiwan rest.
I mean, one assumes, or at least hopes, that the Taiwanese pilots, when they are scrambled, are instructed to operate with maximum restraint. But is there any concern at all that China is, I guess, baiting Taiwan into trying to bait Taiwan into actually having a pop at them?
I think Taiwan would definitely tie the trigger fingers very firmly, you know, down, because they know what the consequences would be. But the last episode that ended badly, which was back in 91, as far as I remember, which was with a U.S. Manned spy plane and a Chinese shock jock fighter pilot. It was the Chinese who flew too close. And I think that probably the bigger danger is, you know, given the heightened nationalism in China coming up to the centenary of the party, all of this is being kind of pumped up as a show of strength for the Chinese population, that some Chinese Air Force pilot might get a little bit too enamoured of his own agility, and that could be very, very dangerous.
Isabel Hilton at China Dialogue, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. It may feel too soon to many listeners to begin reliving the last year and change in human history. As global crises go, a pandemic is that off-putting combination of alarming and boring. If, however, you are going to read one author on the subject, it should surely be Lawrence Wright, whose new book, The Plague Year, America in the Time of COVID, meticulously dissects what happened and what went wrong. The Pulitzer Prize-winning New Yorker staff writer had a head start on two fronts, one by being one of the finest reporters of this or indeed any age, and two by having written shortly before COVID-19 descended a fictional account of a rampaging virus. I spoke to Lawrence Wright earlier. I want to start by asking about not so much the new book as another book you wrote. This was the end of October, a novel you started working on about a pandemic in about 2017. I think you started work on that. How much of a head start did that give you when it came to tackling the actual thing?
Well, it was invaluable in that I got an education in viruses, for one thing, and also about public health. And moreover, I researched that book just as I would any other project. And some of the sources that I developed for the end of October were invaluable with the plague year. For instance, Barney Graham. Barney is an immunologist at the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, which is Dr. Fauci's shop. And he helped me invent the virus in my novel and then helped me cure it when I couldn't figure out how to solve my plot problems. And he's the man who is responsible for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. He invented it. And I had no idea how. I probably had the world's best immunologist helping me with my novel, and then also helping me with my nonfiction book.
Well, just sticking with the end of October, but what was it about that subject that drew you to it?
Well, you know, its roots are in a screenplay that I wrote for Ridley Scott. He wanted me to write about the end of civilization. And so the typical Ridley approach. And I thought about a nuclear war. How does civilization end? But as a young reporter, I had done a number of stories out of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. And I, at that time, I thought this was one of the greatest institutions I'd ever seen. You know, wonderful, noble, intelligent, humble people working there. Ridley never made the movie, and rightfully so, because I hadn't solved the plot problems. But years later, when my wife and I were trekking in England, we were on the Pilgrim's Path, walking all the way to Dover, and I noticed that in the graveyards where we would sometimes take our picnics, there was a date that was so prominent, and that was 1918. And I know that England suffered terribly in the First World War, but 1918 flu killed more soldiers than the war did. And it's a line that runs through the cemeteries all over the world. And it awakened my thinking about what would happen if something like the 1918 flu came back. Would our society be any better prepared than our ancestors were? And when I talked to experts about it, they all said, absent a therapy, a cure, or a vaccine, no, we'd be in exactly the same spot our ancestors were.
There's a real strength in The Plague Year, which I think it has in common with a real strength of The Looming Tower, your book about 9/11 and the events leading up to it, which is describing those moments in the lives of the officials who have to deal with this stuff where it really properly dawns on them, oh my God, this is a thing which is actually happening or has actually happened. Are you able to isolate what that moment was for you in terms of the COVID-19 pandemic, which must have seemed especially weird when you had this novel in your desk drawer? What was the moment for you where you realized, I think this is actually a thing?
Yeah, I knew it was a thing almost from the very beginning because I had the experience of, you know, envisioning it. And I had thought of it as a kind of cautionary tale. But of course, by the time it came out, in April of 2020, there was no more need for a cautionary tale. We were well into the first wave. And it was, as you say, it was weird. It was unsettling. It's happened to me before. I had written a movie called The Siege with Denzel Washington and Bruce Willis about what would happen if terrorism came to America. And this came, you know, suppose it happened in New York City. This was in 1998. And it was a kind of a box office bust, but it was the most rented movie in America after 9/11. And, you know, and everybody was saying how prophetic I was. And just as then and with the novel, it wasn't prophecy. It was just a matter of asking what would happen. You know, usually a journalist asks what happened, but for someone of speculative fiction like this, the question what could happen is similar. And, you know, at talking to public health experts or back then counterterrorists, I could see the world through their eyes, and I just transported that into fiction.
The book does not, and I don't think I'm giving away any endings here, the book does not end up reading as an advertisement for the leadership skills of President Donald Trump. What do you think the parallel universe looks like for the United States in which somebody else was in charge when the pandemic struck?
Andrew, you know, leadership would have made a huge difference. We never had a federal plan. We really needed one. And you can't manage a pandemic without leadership at the top. And at the top, the Trump administration basically didn't want to do anything. Eventually, Trump gave in to the advice of people like Scott Atlas, who were advocating for herd immunity through infection. And the appeal of that is that you don't have to do anything. Of course, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people die if you do nothing. We were bound to lose many people, tens of thousands, but maybe not hundreds of thousands, had we done a better job.
That was Lawrence Wright. His book, The Plague Year, is both unreservedly recommended and available now in paperback. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Finally, on today's programme, we are going to put some of the week's culture and media stories into focus with Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella, who is right here in the studio. Chiara, we're starting with a perennial controversy, it says here, about something which doesn't sound like it should be controversial, this being the mausoleum, which is the final repose of Benito Mussolini.
Indeed. So this is a perennial controversy in Italy. And the latest news is that after some refurbishment, the crypt has reopened to the public. And there was some controversy within the Mussolini family, the heirs themselves, because some wanted it to reopen it, some didn't. But beyond that, I think the most interesting conversation to be had is whether this crypt should be open to the public at all, really, and should be whether it should be a monument at all. And the mayor of the town of Predappio, which is where this crypt is located, who is a right-winger himself, believes that having it there attracts tourism. And of course it does attract tourism. It depends whether you think that, you know, neo-Nazi visitors...
I was just going to say, there's tourists and there's tourists.
Exactly. But there is a significant, you know, money to be made around that, in that there are plenty of souvenir shops in the town of Predappio which will sell you any manner of kind of fascist memorabilia. And in itself, that's quite an interesting controversy in Italy as well, because we do have a law which prevents people from doing apology of fascism. But you can still buy such souvenirs from the town of Predappio. And so, you know, I guess money wins above all.
A friend of mine with a defective sense of humour did once return from Predappio with a Mussolini barbecue apron for me, which I think might still be on my property somewhere. I can't really take the high road on this. Let's move along to a media story. This is GB News, the new news network, which was launched in this country relatively recently. It is terrible. I mean, yeah, just objectively, but advertisers already have an uncomfortable relationship with it.
Yes, indeed. I think it's interesting to note that at launch, it was watched by quite a lot of people, which did watch it perhaps for the spectacle and for curiosity.
Quite a lot in terms of 24-hour news, which doesn't actually get watched by that many people. It's just that it gets watched by a lot of journalists.
Yeah, I guess. And well, let's say that it got watched more than BBC News, but then again, you know, that's been running for quite some time and this has been, you know, long awaited in its own way. But I think it's interesting that the reviews of the programming so far have been quite dismal and that certain advertisers, including IKEA, Nivea, Grolsch and Copperberg, have come out and said that either they will pull the advertising or they will review whether to pull it. Many of them weren't even aware of the fact that they were advertising on there because obviously ad agencies place those ads for them. And then when they found out, because there have been so many calls by activists saying, you know, we have to boycott these advertisers because we don't support this network and this divisive kind of opinions, certain of these advertisers have already come out saying, you know, we don't want to advertise somewhere that goes against our inclusive kind of humanitarian values and have decided to pull their ads already. So I guess this idea that GB News is going to be unbiased and just a new voice that would present an alternative view hasn't quite landed in that same way.
Finally, and very quickly, this sounds encouraging, paying for podcasts.
Yes, I'm sure this news brings a smile to your face to think. No, but this is interesting. So Apple have launched a new in-app subscription subscription service, which is rolling out to 170 countries. And the idea is that you can subscribe to certain channels or to certain podcasts. That means that you can listen ad-free, that you get perhaps early access to shows or such kind of perks. It's interesting because I think it goes in the direction of people being more and more inclined to pay for podcasts. We had a story in a Monocle Minute just last week talking about how in the UK that number is rising, particularly in younger generations. So it might be the case that the Spotify model and the subscription model, a Netflix-style model, may well eventually apply to podcasts too.
Your reminder at this point that Monocle 24 is entirely free. What a bargain you're all getting. Chiara Ramella, thank you as always for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our studio manager was Louis Allen. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time, but don't forget to tune into the Monocle Daily live at 1800 London time. That's 1300 if you are listening on the east coast of the United States. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening.